Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Christian civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you that views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, the views of our guests, and of course we had hoped this evening to have Dr. Farood Fulavand with us. We were going to have him in place of the open lines that we ordinarily would have at this time. However, we don't see any signs of Dr. Fulavand, and so I think we will actually do an open lines program and tell you our telephone numbers, 1-888-24-LIBERTY, that's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But let me just start out with something that Dr. Cuddy had suggested the other day, and that is it reasonable to believe? So I thought if we really want to understand what is going on in the Middle East today, we have to look into the past. And as George Santayana had said, those who do not remember the past are condemned to repeat it. So to understand what's going on in Iraq, you have to understand Vietnam. Now, one of my friends, a good friend who used to work very closely with us here, was a fighter pilot. He flew the F-4 jets over there, and he told me that ordinarily, of course, they'd take off in the morning. There'd be a squadron with three planes, each plane carrying a third of a load of bombs. Now, one plane could have flown up to bomb of the bridge or whatever they were going to bomb. Usually it would be just some little bridge that not much significance that would be rebuilt the next day, but one plane could have done it. Instead of that, they sent three planes, each with a third of a load of bombs up, and of course tripled the expense, tripled the danger and the possibility that one of the planes would get shot down, tripled the risk for the pilots. Is it reasonable to expect that we would have done something like that if we were really trying to win the war in Vietnam? Is it reasonable to expect that our forces, and if you've never read the rules of engagement, we have them, Barry Goldwater was able to get them, and one of the requirements was that if our fighter planes were flying over North Vietnam, and we flew over one of their air bases, and the MiG planes of the North Vietnamese were sitting on the runway or sitting in the field, we couldn't attack them. In other words, as long as those planes were sitting on the field, we couldn't attack them. Only if they were actually in the air fighting at our planes or firing at our planes could we attack them. Is it reasonable to expect if we were really in Vietnam to win the war that they would put restrictions on our fighter pilots, that they couldn't attack MiG planes that might the next day be killing our boys? We couldn't attack them when they were on the ground. And the same was true for the anti-aircraft batteries. Is it reasonable to believe that that during the war, when, of course, North Vietnam was totally dependent upon supplies coming into the country, that they would have restricted the ability of our military to have blocked the port at Haiphong? Certainly the French had sunk a ship in the mouth of the harbor so that other ships couldn't get in, and it would have been very easy to cut off the supplies to North Vietnam by sinking a ship in the mouth of the harbor, but we weren't allowed to do that. We could have mined the harbor at Haiphong. We weren't allowed to do that. We could have bombed the rail yards at Haiphong. Any one of these steps along the way, we could have cut off the military supplies that were being brought into North Vietnam, that were being then taken to South Vietnam to kill our men. But we weren't allowed to do that. We weren't allowed to bomb the rail yards at Haiphong. The rail lines leading from Haiphong. Why would that have happened? Well, we'll be back in a few minutes to discuss some of the inconsistencies of Vietnam that carried over today. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we were just talking about this idea. Would it be logical to expect? And, of course, trying to understand what's going on in the Middle East by understanding what happened in Vietnam. if you look at Vietnam and you know the rules of engagement, and you know that North Vietnam was totally dependent upon a dike system, and if you'd bombed the dikes, you would have flooded North Vietnam, much of Port North Vietnam, and that would have been the end of the war. But would it be reasonable to expect that our pilots would not be allowed to bomb the dikes and end the war? Would it be reasonable to expect that we would not have been allowed to bomb the electric plants there that were providing the electricity for Haiphong and the other cities? And certainly this is a very, very poor country. It was all right to go ahead and bomb the city of Hanoi, only every time you begin to, you know, to really have an impact there to the point where Hanoi was ready to surrender, then that stopped the bombing after we'd killed a lot of people and destroyed a lot of buildings. And why wouldn't you just simply allow them to complete the battle and end the war? And, of course, this really doesn't make sense. Certainly, those of you who have heard my interviews with Colonel Daniel Marvin, he was, of course, head of the Special Forces Unit in South Vietnam. He tells about, of course, the ships that were going up the Mekong River. And they were loaded with weapons that were going to be taken to the other end of the river and then used by the Viet Cong and to kill American boys. And, of course, the foreign ships, had to pass through American checkpoints. But the Americans were not allowed to check and see what was on the boat. All they could look was, you know, what the bill of lading said. And when he was there, why they had this one ship, it had a bill of lading 10,000 tons of toys. Now, why would anybody send 10,000 tons of toys into war-torn South Vietnam and send them by ship up the Mekong River into a wilderness area? Why would you send 10,000 tons of toys? And it was very obvious to the Americans that these were not toys, these were weapons. And yet they were required to let the ship go through. As long as the bill of lading didn't say weapons, they could not inspect the cargo. Is it logical to expect that if we were really involved in a war in Vietnam, that we wouldn't have allowed them to have inspected the cargo of these ships that were passing through our lines to carrying potential weapons? And, of course, Daniel Marvin pointed out that they did watch them. They sent people up to watch the ship unload 10,000 tons of weapons that were used to kill American boys. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and we're simply drawing the analogy between Vietnam and, of course, what is going on in the Middle East today. And this old idea, is it logical to expect? And I simply pointed out that according to the rules of engagement, our planes were not allowed to bomb the dikes in North Vietnam. They were not allowed to bomb the electric plants in North Vietnam. If they'd done either one of them, they could have ended the war. We could not inspect the ships going up the Mekong River that were carrying the weapons that were being taken to the Viet Cong to kill our boys. Is it logical to expect that during the Vietnam War, when the major supplier of weapons to the North Vietnamese were the Russians, the United States and our allies in Europe would lend countless billions of dollars to the Russians who were supplying the weapons that were being used to kill our boys in South Vietnam? Is it logical to expect that the United States during the Vietnam War would have built the Kama River plant in Russia, the largest truck building plant anywhere in the world, and that we would have financed it, we would have put up the technology, we would have built the plant so that they could build the trucks that were then taken by ship through the harbor at Haiphong to be used to take the weapons down the Ho Chi Minh Trail to kill our boys in South Vietnam? Is it logical that that could really have happened? That during that war, why we would have given the Russians the technology to build the anti-aircraft batteries that were used to shoot down our planes? Is it logical that during the Vietnam War, we would have lent Russia billions of dollars and then, many years later, written off those debts? That we would have financed the building of the Fiat motor plant in Russia? Now, the Italians built the plant. We just provided the weapons. Pardon me, we just provided the money for it. Is it logical, if we were really trying to win the war, that we would have supplied the people who were supplying the North Vietnamese who were killing our boys? Is it logical that the greatest and most powerful nation in the world, the United States, would go to war with a nation of North Vietnam, the size of the state of Mississippi, and fight that war for 10 years and lose the war? Is that really logical? I mean, is it logical that we would have given the Vietnamese, the North Vietnamese, a sanctuary in both Laos and Cambodia where they could have their troops and bring their supplies in and down the Ho Chi Minh Trail? And if we would have told our military that they couldn't attack and go into Laos and into Cambodia where the Viet Cong were? I mean, is any of this really logical? I personally, as you've heard me say in the past, talked to William H. Sullivan, who was the American ambassador to Laos during the Vietnam War and later became the American ambassador to Iran just before the second hostage crisis, which is the only one you've ever heard. And sometime I'll tell you about the other things he told me about how we engineered the Iranian hostage crisis, but that's a story for another evening. I interviewed Ambassador Sullivan, William H. Sullivan, when he was at Columbia University back in, I think, 1980. But anyway, he told me, he said, I never understood why we didn't win the war. I'm not a military man. I could have won the war in 2 months if they just let me. I never understood why we never tried to win the war. General Lewis Walt, a four-star Marine general, told me exactly the same thing. We could have won the war in 2 months. We were never allowed to win the war. We rotated something like 10 million men in and out of South Vietnam during the war. And tremendous military forces. Our men fought valiantly. But they were not allowed to win because, you see, the Secretary of Defense, Robert McNamara, was deeply involved in the occult, in Luciferianism. He is the permanent vice president of the Trilateral Commission. He's a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. According to an article we have in West Magazine, he and Henry Kissinger used to go to the occult center in La Boca Grande in Colorado, where the witches and the Satanists and the others went on a regular basis. Certainly we know that Robert McNamara is on the board of directors of the World Future Society, along with the people like Barbara Marx Hubbard, who's one of the leaders of the world occult movement, and Marie Strong, one of the leaders of the occult movement, and the whole background of the World Future Society is the occult. And Chris, if you look at what happened in Vietnam, logically, none of it makes sense. We have the rules of engagement. We sent those boys there to fight and bleed and suffer and die. They were never to be allowed to win the war. Henry Kissinger could have gotten us out in 1968 under the same terms we eventually got out in 1973 and saved the lives of tens of thousands of Americans, but that wasn't his purpose. His purpose was to prolong the war. It was a great diversion. America began to change, and those were the days of the hippies and the flower children and the Supreme Court taking God and prayer out of our schools. Those were the days when they changed our immigration laws and began to centralize power in Washington and legalized abortion. The Supreme Court could do so much damage at that time because, you see, the Americans had our attention focused on Vietnam, not on what was happening here at home. And, of course, the CIA was actually pushing the feminist movement, and there's some people who believe that Gloria Steinem was working with the CIA. Certainly, Timothy Leary, the father of the drug revolution, was working with the CIA, and they were doing everything they could to foster the destruction of the moral fabric of our society. And it was during those years that the moral structure of our society really ended. And premarital sex, simply replaced a premarital chastity, and the idea that you shouldn't, suddenly sleep with a girl before you got married, that went out the door. Suddenly anything goes. We just hook up and just have a great time, and today we have 60 million Americans with a sexually transmitted disease as a direct result of the moral breakdown that began during the Vietnam War, the Great Diversion. And when you understand that, when you understand we never went into the war to win it, we went into the war to transform America. And if you doubt what I say, let me suggest you go to your library and get the January 1967 issue of Foreign Affairs magazine. The lead article is written by McGeorge Bundy. a member of the Luciferian Skull and Bone Society and the Council on Foreign Relations. Big George Bundy was the head of the National Security Agency at that time, the man primarily involved in bringing us into the Vietnam War and so much of the skullduggery. As a member of Skull and Bones, you'd anticipate that. And Big George Bundy writes the lead article in Foreign Affairs magazine in January of 1967, and he says that the title of the article is The End of Either Or, and this is what he says. It would be an act of folly for any true liberal to say that we should have a choice between persistence in Vietnam and full budgetary support for our programs here at home, because exactly the opposite is the case. The road forward at home is by persistence in Vietnam. And if we were to pull out of Vietnam, there'd be tremendous resistance to our domestic policies. And that's what it was all about, ladies and gentlemen. It was all about transforming America. He went on to say anybody who believes in the great new departures in health and education and welfare, in rebuilding our cities, who really believes in equality, shouldn't strengthen the hand of the opposition by saying we should get out of Vietnam, for exactly the opposite is the case. The road forward at home is by persistence in Vietnam. That's what it was all about. And the road forward towards a socialist, fascist America, where all power was centralized in government, was by persistence in Vietnam. And when you understand that, and then we look and see what's going on in Iraq today. Now, first of all, remember that when President George Herbert Walker Bush was going to attack Kuwait in 1991, he sent 695,000 men into the adjacent area, and they were not going to attack Iraq. They were just going to shoo Saddam's very weak forces out of Kuwait. 695,000 men, and then, of course, we never tried to get Saddam Hussein at that time. Now, would it be logical, knowing that, to believe that when we attacked, of course, Iraq in 2003, that they thought they could do the job with 140,000 men, when it was going to take 695,000 to shoo, not even really to confront any of the major parts of the Iraqi army, simply a lot of reserves that were in Kuwait? Why would you send 695,000 men to do a very minor job, and then for a major job of conquering Iraq and then occupying Iraq, you'd only send 140,000 men? Never enough men to do the job? History will tell you that, you know, back when General Allenby took Jerusalem, I think it was 1917, the first thing he did was move in with force and declare martial law. What did we do when we got there? Well, of course, the generals, once we had Baghdad, and that was certainly by about the, oh, let's see, we attacked in March, and certainly by 1st of April, why, we had everything pretty secure, and the generals simply wanted to turn the government over to the Iraqis. They wanted, keep the Iraqi army and the police force and the civil service intact and turn the government over to the Iraqi leaders, the opposition leaders, as we'd promised to do. But, of course, the problem was that they sent over Paul Bremer, who worked for Henry Kissinger. And remember, of course, Henry Kissinger was the architect of the tragedy in Vietnam, and Henry Kissinger was the architect of the tragedy in Iraq today. And Paul Bremer, who had worked for Henry Kissinger, dissolved the Iraqi army, and dissolved the Iraqi police force, and dissolved the Iraqi civil service. What do you think would happen if they did that in New York City tomorrow? There'd be chaos. What do you think they anticipated would happen in Iraq when they dissolved the army and, of course, the police force and the civil service? They knew there'd going to be chaos, and they knew they didn't have enough troops, and they never intended, of course, to have a stability there. If they had stability, how could we justify staying? How could we justify the next step in the war? And I fear the next step in the war is going to be a war with Iran and war with Syria. President Bush is in trouble. There's no way out, and well, we've got some very, very real problems. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, right here at Radio Liberty. Well, let's go to Roger, who's calling from Allentown. How are you doing?
Fine, thank you, Dr. Stan. Hey, I had sort of a combination historical and constitutional question. It's a sort that I've been saving up for Dr. Eitemo, but occasioned by the death now of Gerald Ford, and if I hear, well, thankfully, I guess the syrupy drivel hagiographies are finished now these last few weeks. It's been really awful listening to all these, you know, high integrity and all these other virtues of Gerald Ford. And I was kind of hoping you'd be able to give a qualified answer to the question as to whether, I don't think he necessarily invented the pardon prior to a conviction, but I suspected, rather hoping he did, almost invented it as a precedent. Now, Nixon did it first, I think, with Agnew at least. Maybe some other presidents did it before that. And now, at least in the case of Agnew, which wasn't very much big time, just kind of tax evasion charges, and there was no contesting the guilt there on Agnew's part, I take it, at least.
Oh, I would contest it. I think he was set up. And we have a book written by Spiro Agnew entitled "Go Quietly or Else." And of course, yeah. they threatened to throw his wife in prison indefinitely unless he resigned to the vice presidency. And the whole idea was they wanted to get Spiro Agnew out. Nixon was supposed to appoint Nelson Rockefeller to be vice president, and then Nixon would step down, and Nelson Rockefeller would be crowned king of the United States. That was the plan, and old Richard didn't go along with that because he understood what the implications were. He understood who really runs the country. And when he, of course, did not appoint him, when he appointed Gerald Ford vice president, why, Nixon, of course, signed his own papers of resignation because, of course, they were going to get him. You do not, of course, oppose the rulers of this country. And Nelson Rockefeller was part of that. Gerald Ford knew what he was supposed to do. He appointed Nelson Rockefeller the vice president, and then he kept a low profile. In fact, there was one attempted assassination. I think he's lucky he survived, but Gerald Ford was a very wicked man. And of course, we never talk about that. We never talk about the fact that he was a Mason. He was a member of the Council on Foreign Relations. He was the man who betrayed America when he was on the Warren Commission by actually coming up with the magic bullet theory and pushing that thing through and insisting that they change the autopsy report so that the bullet that entered Kennedy was actually was supposed to have entered much higher than of course it really did enter. He insisted that they modify the autopsy report so they could explain the magic bullet theory. I mean, he and Kissinger went over to Indonesia and, of course, talked to the Sukarno, who was the dictator there, and gave them the okay to move their troops into East Timor and kill 300,000 Christians. And recently they've released, of course, the sealed documents that show that Kissinger told Sahatra, you know, well, don't move your troops in too soon. Give us time to get home before you go in. Knowing full well they were going to kill all those Christians. And certainly Gerald Ford was complicit in that because he did not stop Henry Kissinger from slaughtering all those Christians or giving the okay to slaughter the Christians. So Gerald Ford is not quite the Boy Scout he's been made out to be. We'll be right back in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and our guest this evening did not show up, so we're doing open lines, which we ordinarily do on Wednesday anyway. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. Roger was calling in from Allentown asking about the fact that Gerald Ford had pardoned Richard Nixon before he was ever convicted of a crime. How can you pardon somebody from a crime that they haven't been convicted of? But you see, law and these things really don't matter. Gerald Ford was part of this cabal that runs America. He was a very low individual there, but of course he was well rewarded for his treachery when he served on the Warren Commission by becoming the President of the United States.
Did he virtually invent, or perhaps only second, that bad precedent after Nixon's pardoning of Agnew?
No, but I don't think that he pardoned Agnew. Agnew just stepped down. Agnew was given the opportunity of resigning or simply going to prison, and it was a totally contrived case, in my estimation.
I thought Nixon, in fact, also first pardoned him, but not that Nixon himself necessarily invented, but I thought he might have, and I could be in error there all around, as you suggest. But certainly Ford cemented that awful precedent in stone, and all this lather about the need for all this healing balm, which in retrospect, you know, I don't recall anybody being wounded way back then that we needed all this healing.
Okay, well, I certainly think that, remember, the media is constantly manipulating us. They're creating our reality, and nobody on the media is going to tell you about what happened in East Timor under Gerald Ford's watch. And Kissinger had been over there giving permission for this slaughter of the 300,000 Christians in East Timor. And nobody ever reminded you about his treachery on what he was on the Warren Commission and some of the other things he did. He was an alcoholic. His wife was an alcoholic. They were tragic figures. I think we should pray for him. Anyway,
I think his valuable and inexcusable role, of course, was just as was it true of the Warren Commission, his role in preventing discovery was the real value there. And now one could be over-charitable and say that he, in short-circuiting a trial, deprived Richard Nixon a chance to clear his name by assuming his guilt without benefit of a trial.
Well, what Richard Nixon did? He lied to the American people. You mean to tell me that Lyndon Johnson didn't lie to the American people? That John Kennedy didn't lie to the American people? That other presidents haven't lied to the American people? Hey, we're out of time, but thanks very much for calling, Roger. How's the program coming in tonight?
Oh, very good, and I'm getting you on three frequencies: 7.555, 5.835 and 5.850.
How's the 5.755 coming in?
Probably like the other two a bit better.
Okay, fine. Thanks very much. Bye bye. Okay, let's go to Kevin calling from Austin. And again, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295, and it's Open Line Wednesday. Hi, Kevin. How are you doing?
I'm fine, Dr. Stan. Thank you for taking my call. And I want to commend you just for, you know, being the spokesman of truth. You really are. You're really good. You tell it like it is. And I really appreciate what you said about Nixon there and what he did to foil Rockefeller coming into office, because Rockefeller was a real stinker. I could see that way back when I was a kid. You were...
No, because, you know, it's really so interesting, the relationship between Richard Nixon and the Rockefellers. Richard Nixon was always a wannabe. I mean, he, he was a bright guy, but, you know, certainly after he lost the election in 1960, I will give him credit for one thing, and that is the election was stolen. I mean, he knew that they had used the mafia in Chicago and one other state to steal the election from him, but he didn't contest it because he wanted to preserve this idea that we really have honest elections. And then, of course, he went to California. He was going to run for governor there and began repositioning himself to run for the presidency in either 1966 or 1964 or 1968. Well, when he was defeated there, of course, in 1962, it looked like this was going to be the end of his political career. But he moved back to New York City. He took an apartment right beneath the apartment of Nelson Rockefeller. He went to work for a Rockefeller law firm, and then he spent, of course, the next 6 years running for the presidency, did very little legal work, got very, very fat sums of money. He was the Rockefeller candidate, and he was expected by the Rockefellers to do what he was told to do. And Richard Nixon refused to do what he was supposed to do. When it came, they got rid of Spiro Agnew, they set him up, they got a lot of perjured testimony against him. They threatened to send Agnew's wife to prison if he didn't resign. And then Richard Nixon did the unthinkable. He defied the Rockefellers, and he put Gerald Ford in as vice president. We'll be back in just a moment with Kevin, and welcome your calls. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest didn't show up, so it's open lines. If you're out there and you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here on the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. Well, Kevin, I appreciate your words of encouragement. And are you getting those people down in Austin straightened out as to what's going on?
Not really. Not really. But some of my friends, you know, on some things, and some points. And in fact, I did meet my pastor at the, I told you I went to a Baptist church here, the biggest one, and I asked him about sorcery, if that was what, you know, drugs were, you know, in the Book of Revelation 17, if that was drugs. And he said it was also like calling up spirits, right?
Was
that like masons?
Right, right. Well, at least he has some grasp of what's going on.
He does. And I brought up Skull and Bones at that time, you know, because, you know, here you are, the president is involved in Skull and Bones, and there's all kinds of sorcery involved in that sort of thing. But I just appreciate your memory is so great, Dr. Stan. And it's great because I'm a lot younger than you are, and you can remember the stuff for us and tell us and teach us. So keep it up.
As long as God gives me the ability to remember, and just as hope and pray. Well, I'm taking resveratrol now. I'm taking this new Adderall compound, and I'm just hoping that. And my wife has got me on more vitamins and minerals you can shake a stick at, and something's keeping me going. So,
thank God for your wife. You have a wonderful wife, Dr.
I sure do, and I'm so blessed to have her. God bless you. Thanks
God
very much,
brother,
for calling.
Bye-bye.
Okay, fine. Well, let's see. Is this Ray from Santa Cruz?
Hi, how you doing, Dr.?
I'm doing fine. How are you tonight, Ray?
Did you happen to hear the president's speech tonight?
No, I really didn't. I'll have to admit. I'd like to take a nap between my afternoon and evening programs. And actually, I had to do an extra program for an hour between 5 and 6. So we were sort of strapped for time, and so I didn't hear him. What did you think of his speech?
He pretty much reiterated and repeated the same mantra about the terrorists out to get us, and, you know, and that, of course, they're dedicated to destroying us. Of course, then we're not dedicated to destroying them, you know. It's as if they were out to get us, but we're not out to get them, you know. We're out there to, you know, bring peace to them. And you
hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment, Ray, and I share your concern. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest just didn't show up. We've got Ray. This is open line, so if you'd like to give us a call, our number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And Ray was simply commenting on the president's speech tonight that, you know, this whole idea that if we don't go over there and kill all those Muslims, why, they're going to come over here and kill us. But the trouble with that is, if there's really a threat from terrorism, if the president really believes there's a threat, why haven't they sealed the border? Why do we still have a catch-and-release program for people who come in from terrorist countries, and we catch them coming across the border, and then we immediately release them, and then we never make sure they come back again? And why isn't every pilot armed, and why isn't there marshals on every plane, and why don't we have deflectors on every single plane like the Israelis do to protect them from shoulder-to-air missiles? And there's, why can't we do racial profiling on the flights? And I have to understand this was all planned ahead of time. It is all simply to give us perception that there's a threat from terrorism. If there was really a threat from terrorism, Osama bin Laden would have been able to find one terrorist to come over here and sneak across the border and start derailing trains or poison the water supply or do something. They have to have the enemy so they can take away our freedom. That's what it's about. And justify the expansion of this war in the Middle East. That's what frightens me more than anything. I believe the president is intent upon expanding this war, and there's nobody in Washington, D.C. who has the courage to stand up and say that there's no justification for this, and every person who's killed over there, their blood is on our hands.
Did you hear that Ted Kennedy brought forth a bill about, you know, stopping the war in 6 months or something like that. And the thing about that is that it needs two-thirds vote.
Well, you have to understand that Ted Kennedy plays a part.
He plays a role.
He is a consummate actor. First of all, you have to understand that in the year 2003, the Bush Family Foundation gave their award for the Outstanding Citizen of the Year. Who do you think they gave it to? Ted Kennedy. Now, why would the Bush Foundation, these hardline conservatives, pro-Americans, give it to a frank subversive like Ted Kennedy? Because it's all a game. And because Ted Kennedy wants to stop the war, then we ought to continue the war. Anything Ted Kennedy wants, we should oppose. He's simply playing a part.
Yeah,
and they control the right, they control the left, they control the Republicans, they control the Democrats, they control the conservatives and the liberals, and there's no much place for the rest of us to go. Because there is no leadership out there, and any leadership there is, they surround and neutralize.
Yeah. Yeah, that's the tragedy of it. What took so long to happen, I'm not saying, I wouldn't say that President Kennedy was such a nice guy, but he wanted to dismantle the CIA and put all covert operations under the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I think he sent a memo saying that, and that's probably one of the reasons why he got killed, but I think, this has been going on for so long. It just started about probably a half century ago.
I think you're absolutely right. But this, really, it's been going on really since the very inception of America. It really started getting bad. In 1913, after Woodrow Wilson became president, and Colonel Edward Mandel House, who was deeply involved with the occult, was able to hypnotically control Woodrow Wilson. He was able to really run this man. In fact, Woodrow Wilson said of Colonel House, "He is my alter ego. He is my alter ego." A man who has never elected any office controlled the government of the United States, until eventually, at the behest of the president's wife, Edith Bowling Wilson, Wilson broke with House, and shortly after that, he had a stroke and was incapacitated. But Colonel House was really the one who was responsible for all these dramatic changes, the 16th Amendment, the 17th Amendment, the Federal Reserve Act, some of the antitrust laws, and this beginning of the centralization of power in Washington, D.C. But certainly it got a lot worse under Lyndon Johnson and Ted Kennedy.
The other thing, too, looking back on, in ancient history, President Roosevelt, he didn't want to stop the concentration camps from, flourishing the way they were in Germany. I don't think he would have done anything to stop them had it not been for the fact that, Britain probably put pressure on us to get into the war more than anything,
Well, of course, many of the Jewish people wanted us to bomb the rail lines. They even wanted us to bomb Auschwitz to stop it. If you bombed them, they were going to die anyway. At least destroy the camps so more couldn't be taken in. But, of course, Roosevelt and Churchill wouldn't do that. The idea was to kill off as many of the Jews as they could, because both of them were deeply involved in the occult. Both FDR and Winston Churchill were deeply involved in the occult. Until people understand that, you can't understand anything that's going on today.
Didn't Churchill stop the news from getting out that the Germans had been involved in a lot of the occult? And wasn't he one of the ones that kind of prevented the information from getting out?
Certainly the Germans were deeply involved in the occult, but so was Winston Churchill.
Yeah.
And so are the leaders of our country. And this is what people don't understand, is that there are these powerful spiritual forces that are always working behind the scenes, and we're going to have a great new video out here later this month. And it's simply going to take you to Washington, D.C., where you'll see all the signs of the zodiac. I think there are 23 complete signs of the zodiac and over 1,000 figures from the zodiac all over Washington, D.C., representing the occult influence that's there. Now, there's a Christian influence that's there, too. But what people don't understand is the dualism. On one side, the Christian, the worship of the God that we worship, and on the other hand, of course, the worship of the other God.
Oh.
And that is what people don't understand, is there more than one God out there. There's the true God, and then there's the god of the underworld. And there really are people in our government today who worship the other god.
Jimmy Carter, you know, professes to be a Christian. I'm kind of confused about that because, you know, I think you mentioned before that he had been involved with the Lucius Trust or...
Yes, actually, the Carter Foundation finances the world group of the new group of world servers, which is a branch of the Lucius Trust, which is a Luciferian organization, and we actually have the documentation on that. Hey, we're going to have to run, mm-hmm. Ray. Anything else you'd like to say before we let you go?
I figured you might hear President Bush, but you know, it was the same old thing. You know, you knew what to, I knew what to expect, and he didn't say anything different than he's been saying for the past couple of years.
What I'm going to do, of course, is go to the whitehouse.gov, pull down the speech tomorrow, yeah. and just sit down and analyze it word for word.
Okay.
God bless, and thanks so much for calling, Ray. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY, or 464-8295. And if you have a question, a comment, give us a call right now. We have a Robert calling from Aurora, Colorado. Hi, Robert. How are you doing?
Good evening, Dr. Monti. Thank you for taking my call.
Little cold there in Colorado?
Well, actually, it's pretty nice. Tomorrow and Friday and the weekend will be bitterly cold plus some snow, but what can you do? Pray for it.
Right.
thanks for taking my call, and thank you for the open lines every Wednesday. That really gives an opportunity for people to ask you questions and pick your brain. A quick Vietnam question, then a constitutional question. I've heard and then I've read that then Captain Colin Powell originally investigated the My Lai massacre. Is that true?
I really can't comment on that. I don't know.
Okay. I've heard
but
that.
He was over there, and he was part of the cover up. But what his position was at the time, I don't know.
But the thing is,
Certainly, the military covered that up. They did everything they could to keep the information from getting out. And there were other similar instances. And you have to understand, Robert, that in war, people do terrible things. And I mean, when it's your life or somebody else's, sometimes you do terrible things. And as far as My Lai is concerned, there's a wonderful book that was written by, I think, Seymour Hersh about My Lai. You can understand, on one hand, these men, they were not very smart. They were, you know, a lot of very, very common people. And they had a tremendous camaraderie, and they'd never lost a man, and suddenly they got into a minefield, and they lost, you know, a couple of dozen of their people, and this had a tremendous psychological impact, and then they were told to go in and kill those people. They were all enemies. And they did it, and they never should have raped the women and children, and there's no justification for what happened. But you almost go mad sometimes in battle. You live in constant fear, and then you strike out at everybody, and this doesn't in any way justify it. But war is hell.
Yeah, God.
But then they covered it up, and there were many similar incidences over there. Not that our soldiers are any worse than anybody else's, but when you put a man into a situation like that, many times he'll do things he would never do in a civilized society.
I agree. In Houston recently, there was an interesting situation I want to throw at you, see what you think. A young man and his gang buddies broke into a building and robbed the place, and in so doing, there was a gun battle. Shots were exchanged between the gang members and the building owner. The gang members were arrested and fingered this kid, and the police caught up to him and questioned him, and they noticed there was a scar or a knot or whatever in his forehead, and they investigated further and realized that there was a bullet in his forehead, and so they're wanting to or already have filled out or filed a search warrant to have that bullet removed. The kid and his mother doesn't want to do that because if the bullet is removed, ballistics will show that he was in fact part of that crime. Correct me if I'm wrong, Fifth Amendment protects us against self-incrimination. But I'm wondering what your feeling is on that. Do you think the Constitution protects him, or should the police be allowed to remove that bullet, which would then prove that he was part of that crime?
I think that certainly you have a right to search somebody. I personally believe that they get a judge to issue a direction. That would be something that would be certainly acceptable. And I admit that it's sort of a borderline area, but you know. you can go either way on him. Personally, I think that if this is a hardened criminal, he's been involved in shootouts, you know, that they have a right to search him, they have a right to search, but they have to, they can't simply do a general search looking for things. They have to be specific in what they want to do, and they, of course, they want to search that bullet that's in his forehead. So I think that they can get, probably they could get a judge to give him a warrant to do it. It's going to be interesting to see what happens.
Yeah, and I guess you say there's clear probable cause because he does have a bullet in his forehead.
Right.
That's kind of unusual. Okay. Thanks for taking my call, and God bless you with the good work.
God bless. Thanks very much. Okay, let's go to Tony, who's calling from Tennessee. Hi, Tony. How you doing? Tony, is this Tony? Oh, who? I'm sorry. I guess we have the wrong one. I'm not sure who we have on the line. Is there nobody there? All right, we'll put you on. All right. Is this Tony? Oh,
yes, it is.
Okay, fine. Go ahead.
You know, I was listening to the president's speech tonight, and he pretty much told us what he's going to do, didn't he?
Well, I think. What do you think he's going to do?
Well, I mean, he said he sent a carrier ship over there because he can't allow Iran to get nuclear weapons.
Well, that's his justification for basically what we already have one carrier force over there. That's the Eisenhower Task Force.
Oh, we have several ships over there.
They're
right
sending
now
over the John Stennis carrier task force. And then they have the Boxer, and it's not a carrier task force. Apparently, it's some sort of a strike group. I've been looking into it. It's four or five ships. Sounds like they're loaded with Marines ready to go ashore. So, yes, we're putting an awful lot of military force over there. And, you know, what you do is when you're in a real mess, and, you know, everybody's yelling at you for the mess you got in, what do? Why, you simply do something else. You back away from one thing, and you do something else, and if he goes into Iran and he can overthrow the government there, and he'll be a real hero. And, of course, if he goes into Iran and he doesn't win the war, and, of course, if it gets worse and we end up in the Third World War, why, he'll still be a hero.
I know, Doc, but, you know, this is absolutely crazy.
I know. We live in a world gone mad, Tony. This is the problem.
This is madness is what it is, absolute madness.
And, of course, the implications are going to be that, you know, the price of oil will skyrocket, you know, like 4th of July. And I fear that we're going to inflame the entire Muslim world against it. And I think that's what this is really all about. The one thing I would say is that George Bush does not make the decisions. I mean, people try to make you think that he's the Winston Churchill. He's the courageous man who's standing there. Everybody is against him, but he knows what's best for our country. George W. Bush is simply a figurehead for the powerful people behind him. And when he moves his right arm, why, watch Dick Cheney. He's pulling the strings.
I first met you in 95 at a little church in Westminster.
You did?
Yes. David Bay was there just getting into what was going on. And at that time you said we're headed for a dictatorship.
I think I haven't changed my mind at all.
No. It's all come true.
You've got to help us get the word out and get people listening to our programs and get them to get. They can go up on the internet now and see our Brotherhood of Darkness. Somebody put it on Google, and so you can watch it there for nothing. Just type in, Brotherhood of Darkness video, and you can get that on Google and watch it. And of course, we hope you want to get the regular one and show it, but yeah, at least get people to listen and watch and begin to understand that we're involved with these satanic forces.
You know, Dr. Stan, when I first met David Bay in 95, I think it was, I mean, he was kind of coming unglued what he was finding out, too, and as I was, although I knew somewhat a little bit then, I've learned a lot more since then, and my wife couldn't take it. She just didn't want to hear it, and that's really the way it is with most people I try to tell.
I know.
And I get laughed at, I get called a kook, and I'll be honest with you, I think when this country gets it, it's because we deserve it.
But our job is to keep trying to warn people about what's going on. We're the watchman on the wall, Tony. They described it in Ezekiel 3 and Ezekiel 33. Our job is to sound the alarm. people don't want to listen to us, their blood is on their hands. But we're reaching more people, and I will tell you that more and more people are becoming aware. They know something's wrong.
Oh,
it's
yeah.
How we present the issue. Ask questions. Don't grab them by the lapel and shake them. Don't tell them they're stupid because they won't believe the way you do. Ask them questions. Is it reasonable to accept or to expect that? I mean, we would send 695,000 troops into the Middle East back in 1991 just to shoo the troops out of Saddam's troops out of Kuwait. And only send 140,000 to take over Iraq and, you know, after dissolving the army and creating the chaotic situation, is it reasonable to believe that this could happen just by accident? If we get people to think, we can still wake them up. But in the end, Tony, it's the Lord's battle. If you recognize that, then you won't get discouraged.
Yeah.
God bless.
Thanks for your time.
Thanks very
good
much.
Night.
We'll be back in just a moment to wrap up this evening's program here at Radio Liberty. Well, we had Jeff from Denver on the line. I don't know what happened to Jeff. If he wants to call back, well, we'll be glad to take his call here. We've got just a couple of minutes before we wrap up this program. But I think, you know, if you analyze what's going on, why do we want to send more troops in, 20,000 more troops into Iraq? If you really wanted to win the war, you'd send in 500,000 troops, and you would do away with, of course, the Mahdi's army. There are about at least 20 militias, independent militias operating in Iraq, in Baghdad today. What's happening is it simply the death squads are going through. The Shias are killing the Sunnis. The Sunnis are killing the Shias. I believe, and of course, we're provoking a lot of these, a lot of the car bombings. I believe this is all being done to create this chaotic situation, because if there wasn't chaos, how could we possibly justify staying there? And then, of course, it's not very hard to get the Shias to hate the Sunnis, and the Sunnis to hit the Shias. And what they're doing, these people are being forced to leave their homes and their businesses, and to flee with nothing but their clothes on their back as they see their neighbors being slaughtered. And anybody who can leave Iraq is left. And the rest of the people don't have the money to leave. They don't know where to go. The Christians, 70% of the Christians who lived in Iraq under the wicked Saddam Hussein, and many that prospered and did very well, 70% have fled because we have created a state in Iraq under Sharia law. This is the Constitution. Nobody's telling you. What we did is we took a secular state that was under a vicious dictator, that we had financed Saddam Hussein. We had kept him in power. And if you read the book we carry, See No Evil by Robert Baer, we carry the book, See No Evil by Robert Baer, who was a CIA agent operating in Iraq, at least in the Kurdish part of Iraq, all during the 1990s, mid part of the 1990s. He said he never met an Iraqi citizen who did not believe the United States was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. He never met an Iraqi citizen who did not believe Saddam Hussein, or the United States was keeping Saddam Hussein in power. And then he describes in the book two instances where the military wanted to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and in each instance, they were betrayed by the American government. How could that possibly be? Because I believe everything over there is contrived. And I believe, of course, the attack on Iraq was simply a prelude to the coming attack on Iran and Syria. And with that, of course, will come increasing violence. And yes, the people over there hate us, but it's because we're occupying their country. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when I really need to remind all of our listeners out across America that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope that many of you will give serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because quite frankly, we need your help to continue doing what we're doing. And once we get things consolidated, why, of course, we'd love to expand the stations we have, but right now we just want to maintain the stations we have, and so we can continue reaching people all across America. So if you'd like to join the Radio Liberty family, our telephone number is 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. Now, let me suggest that I believe we're going into very, very serious times. If you'd like to know what to do financially, you really need to get my talk on the Financial Tsunami, and it's available in DVD or in video, and then there's a syllabus that goes with that. And certainly, it was a talk we gave about 9 months ago, but it's just as true today, and all the documentation is there. It will help you to grasp what's going on and to know what you should do. And I'm not a financial advisor. I will tell you what you do. You diversify, you diversify, you diversify. You don't have all of your eggs in one basket, because somebody might come along and crush that basket. Then, of course, you better be prepared for the difficult times, and you probably should be laying in supplies of emergency food. If you'd like a catalog, we'd be glad to provide it for you. You need something so you'll know you'll be able to have water. You can't live without that. You get by without food, but not without water. Think seriously about getting a Berkey of some sort, a big Berkey, a Berkey Light, something of that sort, so you can filter water. And the information is available at our website at radioliberty.com. Lay in a supply of medical supplies, and I'm talking about the vitamins and minerals and the various things that you need to keep your health up. Because if we get into a difficult time, food may be difficult to come by, unless, of course, you can grow it in your backyard. But at least you have the supplements. You're going to be able to maintain your health. You're going to have your help. I don't know whether they're going to precipitate a major epidemic. I think this is one thing they're planning. Or they're going to have a great deal of civil unrest. Or whether they're going to have an attack on our country from outside. I don't know what they're going to do, but I do know that they've covered all the contingencies in the John Warner Defense Appropriations Act that allows the president to declare a military dictatorship and martial law in America in case of civil unrest, in case of an epidemic, in case of, of course, a natural disaster in America. And if you don't think they can create natural disasters, why, you ought to go back and read Zygmunt Brzezinski's book, Between Two Ages, there, written in 1970, where he talks about how in the future they're going to be able to create chronic diseases to disable the people, and how they're going to be able to create storms, and how they're going to be able to create droughts. I wonder how he knew about those things back in 1970 when he wrote the book. Remember, this is one of the key players in this whole drama that's unfolding today. He's the man who was recruited by David Rockefeller to form the Trilateral Commission. He was the man who was in charge of the National Security Council when we actually helped Saddam Hussein to come to power in 1979, when we brought the Ayatollahs to power in 1979, when we precipitated the Afghan War, got the Soviets to invade Afghanistan, to begin this 8-year war that killed so many people and was so destructive to that tragic country of Afghanistan. And of course, allowed us then to train the Mujahideen in techniques of terrorism and radical Islam. That was the key. What everybody's forgotten, we were pushing the radical Islamic movement. If you haven't read the book, The Devil's Game, you need to get it. You need to get the material available from Radio Liberty. Foreknowledge 911. Three little pamphlets, compilation of our newsletters, they're available. Give us a call at 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. And please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. And we'll be back here in just a moment or two with our second hour here at Radio Liberty. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at. Illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views, and, well, the views of our guests. Now, for this next hour, we're going to have with us a Mr. Richard Hellman, and we're going to talk about what's going on in the Middle East and what's happening in the Near East. And, of course, all you need to do is look at Israel. I think the people of Israel are becoming increasingly, disillusioned that their leaders certainly are not doing the right thing. They're trading 300 or 400 Palestinians for one captured Israeli. Why would you release hardened Palestinian terrorists, 400 or 300 or 400 of them, for one Israeli soldier? That doesn't make sense. Any more than one time they gave, I think, 400 Palestinian terrorists for the bodies of 3 Jewish soldiers. Why would you do something like that? Why is the United States refurbishing the helicopters for Egypt, the military helicopters? They're howitzers. Why are we providing weapons for the Fatah terrorists who are fighting the Hamas terrorists, but they're still going to use those weapons against Israel? And then it was a terribly unstable situation in Lebanon today, where, of course, the Hezbollah there, funded by Iran, and, of course, the Iranians have provided the Hezbollah with weapons. And, well, anyway, let's get Mr. Hellman's view of what's going on, because to me it looks like a tinderbox. Richard, why don't you tell us just a little bit about yourself?
Thank you. Good to be with you. I am a Christian, a Bible-believing Christian, and shortly after, within a year and a half after I came to be a believer, the Lord gave us the unction and the desire to go to Israel and opened a door where I went there to help Israel with its environmental and water laws and policies, and actually help create the plans for their Ministry of Environment that was created afterwards. And after about 7 years there, thought I'd be there just for a year or two, but after almost 7 years in Israel with my wife and my then 2 teenage daughters, having learned the Hebrew language, having lived among the Israelis, having my daughters in Israeli high school, I felt that we really should come back to America and explain what Israel's situation was, what great threat Israel was under from its neighbors, from its Arab and Islamic neighbors. So we came back to America and set up CPAC, the Christian Lobby for Israel, Christians Israel Public Action Campaign, and have been working diligently for complete fairness and equality, indeed favor whenever we can, for Israel in U.S. law and policy.
Well, of course, it looks to me like, of course, Israel's in real trouble today, but bothers me even more, it looks like America's going to get involved in a war with Iran and with Syria and inflame the entire Islamic world. I don't know what the solution is. What do you think the solution is, Richard?
Well, I believe that we must follow out our policies that have been announced, and we must implement America's best values and principles in our foreign policy, as we hope to do in our domestic policies.
Well, of course, the thing is, do we want to go to war with the entire world? Right now, we've got our troops, we got our forces fighting in Somalia. Certainly, American planes have been involved there. We have troops stationed in 130 nations throughout the world. I would think that America's policy, and most Americans, would simply like to leave the rest of the world alone, and certainly, maybe the rest of the world would leave us alone if we weren't dominating the world. But we'll get to your thoughts on this when we get back here at Radio Liberty. But I will tell you that the Middle East is a tinder cake, is a tinderbox today just waiting to explode. So, Richard, if you were the President of the United States, what would you do right now?
Well, I would walk out the policies that I have announced. In other words, the President has said after 9/11 and repeatedly, as you know, that you are either with us or against us in this global war on terror. And if you harbor a terrorist, if you shelter a terrorist, if you fund or support or applaud a terrorist or create a haven for a terrorist, you are a terrorist. And so by that definition, Iran, Syria, Hezbollah in the south of Lebanon, and virtually all of the leadership of the Palestinian Arab people are terrorists.
And so should we kill them all?
Oh, no, I don't
then,
believe
then how can we possibly... they're going to fight to the death. They feel that we're the crusaders, that we're in their country, we're occupying their country. How can we change that perception?
Well, I believe that there are a number of actions that we can take short of military action. For example, with respect to Iran, at this very time, we have sent out an alert throughout the United States asking that Americans have their congressmen and women support a resolution that Congressman Steve Rothman of New Jersey, a Democrat, and Congressman Mark Kirk of Illinois, a Republican, and a number of other Republicans are going to introduce formally within the next few days. This resolution will call upon the UN Security Council to charge President Ahmadinejad of Iran with incitement to genocide against Israel and the Jewish people. This is something that he has done more than 50 times in the last year, incited his people and other Muslims to hatred and death for the Jewish people and particularly Israel. And this constitutes crimes against humanity, really, hate crimes and hate speech. Under the Genocide Convention and under the UN Charter.
So what are you going to do about it? Are you going to go to war with Iran?
It may not come to war, but you are going to say that it is very much like 1938 once again, and President Ahmadinejad is very much like Adolf Hitler.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back here in just a moment. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and I was simply asking Richard what he felt should be done. He feels that we should pass a resolution, and it would be condemning, of course, President Ahmadinejad of Iran for some of the statements he's made, like Israel will be wiped off the face of the map, the West will be is in decline, that there was no Holocaust. And he certainly makes an awful lot of foolish and inflammatory statements, almost as if he's acting, as if he's doing everything he can to incite a war. I mean, who is this man, Ahmadinejad? How could he be so stupid and intensely? Why would he say this? These inflammatory things?
Yeah.
Of course, knowing full well that his actions would certainly bring a tragedy to his country. In fact, in the recent elections over there, he lost a great deal of support from the Iranian people. The Iranian people don't want to go to war. So what were you suggesting? We pass a resolution, but a resolution doesn't have any real effectiveness.
Oh, yes.
Unless, of course, we go to war and really to send more American boys to die.
No, I don't believe that. I believe that, in fact, just as if we had stood up to Adolf Hitler in 1938 and not have encouraged and applauded Prime Minister Chamberlain at Munich, appeasing Adolf Hitler, we could have stopped Hitler before World War II and before 20 million people, including 6 million Jews, were killed. And I believe that so too today, terrible as the war in Iraq is, we have lost over 3,000 American men and women in that war over 4 years. Being a veteran of Vietnam, I grieve for every one of those, just as I very much remember and grieve for the two, actually three, men that we lost in Vietnam in our small counterintelligence unit. However, these losses still are relatively light compared to our other wars. As I say, I grieve for each one, but we are fighting for a principle, and we are fighting there so that the terrorists do not come here and once again assault us on the streets of Washington and Los Angeles and New York and Chicago. And I believe that if we take the right actions, if we surgically attack, if need be, the havens of terror in Iran and Syria, it is not going to produce a wider war, but instead it is going to show that America is a forceful defender of freedom and democracy, and in fact the bullies will back down, just as Hitler would have backed down if we had resolutely opposed him.
Well, I don't understand why President Bush refused to go into Pakistan and get Osama bin Laden. Supposedly he was the guy responsible for 9-1-1. Why wouldn't they let our forces go after Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan? And why wouldn't they just say, we don't care about your border in Pakistan, we're going to get Osama bin Laden? I just don't understand. If we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why we didn't get the terror master?
I don't understand that either. And I have heard, if in fact these reports are true, for example, Gary Bernson in the book Jawbreaker speaks of the failure to land a force of Rangers on the border and cut off Osama bin Laden's retreat. His forces, he and his forces were retreating toward the border with Pakistan, and they were being pursued by a high-tech special operations team comprising special forces from the military arms and special CIA teams with a heavy input of Air Force high-tech high-velocity munitions, bombs and missiles. Why we did not put that unit of Rangers, a battalion or brigade, I forget exactly how large a unit was requested, why that was not put there to block Osama bin Laden's retreat, I can't answer. History will tell whether, in fact, an excess of caution or something else led us not to go in for the kill against Osama bin Laden if these reports are accurate. But I think it argues all the more today for us resolutely and aggressively attacking terrorists where they are found, as we have done in Somalia. And by the way, I've spoken about genocide coming against the Jewish people from Iran. You know full well, Stan, and your listeners should know about the ongoing genocide in Darfur, in western Sudan, where Islamic radicals, the so-called Janjaweed, which stands for devils on horseback, these mounted terrorists with support from gunships and other air support from the Khartoum central government, have killed in excess of 400,000 men, women, and children, driven more than 2 million from their homes in Darfur and western Sudan, driven them as far away as the neighboring country of Chad and beyond, and have repeatedly raped tens of thousands of their women. And yet, and President Bush, well, to his credit, has constantly sounded the alarm, but he has not been able to provoke an adequate response from the United Nations to stop this genocide, so that just as with President Clinton in Rwanda and so many other times, never again has not meant never again.
I certainly share your concern about what's going on in Darfur, and that's an entirely different subject, but I certainly think that certainly what we're seeing in Africa today is one of the great great human tragedies. Well, you know, there are some people who think that Ahmadinejad and his followers, because they are members of something called the Hojatiya Society, that really wants to bring back the 12th Imam. And they really believe that the only way to do this would be to plunge the world into war, that if we go to war with Iran, we'll be doing exactly what they want. Do you think there's any truth to that? That they honestly believe that the Islamic Messiah will come back when the world has been plunged into a Holocaust?
Either they really believe that they have the power to precipitate the Imam's emergence or return, or they cleverly and cynically manipulate their fervent followers with this vivid apocalyptic image so as to control them, so as to remain in power, and so as to have them overlook the decline of the Iranian economy and the rampant poverty that coexists beside still vast oil wealth. So I feel that it may be a cynical ploy by President Ahmadinejad, and even more by the Council of Ayatollahs who really have the power there in Iran. But I believe we must be resolute in opposing him, the President of Iran, and in pointing out who he is without any hyperbole or exaggeration. He is a new Hitler arising on the scene. It is like 1938 today, and the main difference is that as he cynically exploits hatred against the Jews, diminishes them, caricatures them, denies the Holocaust, and more, and also claims that they are the source of all evil in the world, he keeps his people under control, he stays in power, and he prepares for the possibility that he will have nuclear weapons deliverable by long-range ballistic missiles, surely against Israel, if he carries out his plans, but also against Europe before long, and against America shortly after that.
You really think that, that he would like to attack America?
Well, he at least wishes to have the capability to do so, so that he can be the dominant power in the Middle East.
But as with
Hitler, we can't afford the luxury of hoping and praying that he really doesn't mean what he says.
But isn't this exactly what George Bush said about Saddam Hussein? We have to go in there. We've got to get him because he's going to have these weapons of mass destruction. He's going to attack the United States, and we've killed 600,000 Iraqi civilians. Now, admittedly, we haven't killed them all, a lot of them, but they wouldn't be dead if we hadn't gone in there. Do you think George Bush was justified in going in to Iraq and with the death of 600,000 Iraqis, the blood, whose hands is that blood on? If we hadn't gone in, this would not have happened.
Well,
don't we bear responsibility? Aren't men and women responsible for the things that their government does? And what about their lives? We talk about the 3,000 Americans, and I'm concerned about them. But what about the 600,000 Iraqis have died?
Well, I am not sure that I do not know that is...
Well, what happens if it's just 100,000?
The accurate figure is...
What happens if it's 100,000?
No, I understand, and it is a grievous loss. And it is altogether possible that Iraq was not the principal target, and we could debate that, and in fact, Saddam Hussein had used weapons of mass destruction against his own people, the Kurds in the north and the Shiites in the south, and against Iran. And
but who gave him the weapons of mass destruction? Where did he get the material to build those chemical weapons? We'll be right back here with Mr. Hellman. And, of course, Mr. Hellman was saying that Saddam had used these weapons of mass destruction. I've talked with people from the special forces who were over there helping him. In other words, our government was helping him use the chemical weapons against the Iranians after he'd used it on the Kurds. How could, you know, this is totally immoral, and I am concerned when my government does immoral things. And I think that when we've done immoral things, people who have done immoral things have to be held responsible. Don't you think that's true?
Well, Stan, I can't confirm or deny from my own experience or from my own knowledge or from anything that I can credibly affirm that, in fact, our special forces, as you say, were assisting in that. If they were, certainly, this is an abomination and inexcusable. I cannot, there is no excuse for that kind of behavior. America has made many mistakes. At the same time, America has a great power. With that power comes responsibility and opportunity. We pray, but also we work. We explore, we counsel, and we advise our members of Congress, our senators and representatives, and whenever possible, our State Department and the Pentagon and the White House, in ways that we would hope would reflect the best instincts of the American public. Not God forbid, to be warmongers or to wade into wars without thinking, but at the same time, not to let ongoing epidemics of hate crimes and hate speech, such as Darfur and Western Sudan, to continue, or new ones to arise, as with the very credible threats of Iran against Israel and the Jews, very credible because they already are starting to implement them through Hezbollah, Hamas, and others.
Well, I certainly am very, very concerned. I just don't know what the solution is. You know, recently we find that the United States is doing everything they can to help improve the Egyptian military. We're actually refurbishing their helicopters. We're refurbishing their howitzers. We're actually giving rifles to the members of Fatah, you know. Obviously, anything we give to the Fatah is going to eventually be used against Israel. Why would we be doing things like that? It just doesn't make sense.
Stan, we oppose each of those things that you mentioned. We are almost alone, but we, as the Christian lobby, CPAC, the Christian lobby for Israel and for American interests, we oppose those actions resolutely. And we are asking our Congress, and we call upon all Americans ask their senators and representatives to cut off any foreign aid or any military assistance to Fatah, which is the PLO, which has killed Americans repeatedly. We cannot arm the so-called good terrorists to fight in a mini civil war against the bad terrorists. This is a despicable policy. As you may know, we have even had a United States general in Jericho with military trainers helping to beef up the PLO, the Fatah forces.
Hold that thought for this.
Abu Mazen.
Hold that thought. They're right there. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Richard was just saying that we've had recently an American general with special forces, or at least military forces, actually in the city of Jericho, which is, of course, in the Palestinian area, helping to train the Palestinian forces there. And anybody with an ounce of sense knows that as we train the Palestinian forces, they're going to be used against the Jews. And I was simply quoting during the break that, you know, certainly we're doing everything we can to build up Egypt's military. Now, I read within the last 48 hours, we've refurbished the military helicopters, refurbished their howitzers. Why are we preparing Egypt for war? That doesn't make sense. Why are we giving rifles? I think, I don't know, 100,000 rifles, or anyway, an awful lot of rifles to the Fatah group. You know, why would we give them military equipment? Why
would we
be training them? So many things are going on over there, Richard, just don't make sense from a logical point of view.
Well, Stan, you're absolutely right. I believe it was 2,000 rifles and 20,000 rounds of ammunition for starters, and we allowed Egypt to ship arms across from the Sinai into Gaza for the PLO forces of Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, the relatively powerless president of the Palestinian Arab Authority. And this is after we looked the other way while Israel tried, often ineffectually because of the magnitude of the problem, to block the tunneling from Sinai into Gaza in the last year before Israel, I believe unwisely, turned Gaza over to the PLO terrorists. In that last year before that, there had been more than 100 tunnels, some of them massive, drilled under the border, dug under the border between Egyptian-controlled Sinai and the Gaza. And through those tunnels had streamed vast amounts of ammunition and arms and anti-tank rockets and even anti-aircraft rockets, and some of the materials that have gone into these Qassam rockets that are still raining down on Israel. And so, in short, we were ineffective. In fact, sadly, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice worked diligently and felt it was her great achievement to keep the border open between Sinai and Gaza and between Gaza and Israel, even, I'm afraid, at the risk of Israel's security and America's security.
And I agree with you.
Also at risk.
I agree with you totally. That, our attitude towards what's going on in Israel is just unexplainable. Certainly the Baker Commission, Baker-Hamilton Commission, it was almost as if they were going to write off Israel and try to make peace with Syria and Iran. And, and putting tremendous pressure on the Israelis not to respond to the rocket attacks that are coming into their country. The only way to deal with terrorists is you attack them, and if whenever they fire a rocket, you should go and you should blow it up. And if they've done it from a civilian area where there's civilians there, as tragic as it may seem, you're going to have to take that area out. You have to kill the terrorists. But you know, one of the things that really bothers me, Richard, is we're hearing now that Olmert is planning on releasing some 400 Palestinian terrorists in exchange for one kidnapped Israeli soldier.
Yes.
How could you, in your right mind, I'm not suggesting that you would do this, but I'm saying, how could any person in the right mind do something that foolish unintentionally?
Well, Stan, Dr. Stan, I agree wholeheartedly with the implication of your question. Some years ago, there were approximately 1,000 Israeli-held terrorists released in exchange for a handful of Israelis, I believe, as you said, actually just reports on their demise and their remains.
I think there were three. The remains of three Israelis. Why would you do something like
that?
And
there was a sad and tragic joke at that time in which the Israelis themselves said, "It just shows you how bad devaluation has become." And but seriously, this is a loss of principle, and if America encourages and promotes this kind of move in a false move toward something which we could call peace, I just say, you know, at the very least, shame on us, because it's going to redound to our disadvantage. And I, for example, look at the fact that the United States has encouraged the entry, if need be, of the Badr Brigade of the Palestinian Liberation Army, so-called, which is an illegal army, not authorized under any of the agreements that the Palestinian Arabs, the PLO, signed with Israel and America. There are plans afoot to let this brigade come in from Jordan to beef up Abu Mazen.
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Well, Well, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest this evening is Richard Hellman, and he certainly is an American, a Christian, but he's very concerned about Israel, as am I. I mean, you think about what's going on over there, but so many of the policies of our government just don't make sense, whether it be our policies in Iraq, whether it be our policies in Afghanistan, whether it be our policies towards forcing Israel. I mean, you know, to back down on so many important issues. In fact, you know, when we had the recent Israeli war with Lebanon, whether they should have gone in or not, we might debate, but once you'd gone into it, you should have finished the job. And they didn't allow them to finish. They forced them to quit halfway through, and by forcing them to quit halfway through, they ended up forcing them to lose the war. What are your thoughts about the way that we put pressure on Israel to back out of Lebanon after they were, you know, were on the verge of destroying Hezbollah, and they pulled defeat out of the jaws of victory?
Yes, there is a great truth there, Dr. Stan, because President Bush, after fairly resolutely standing behind Israel for about 6 weeks, then did, when the tide was turning, let the United Nations pass a Security Council resolution, 1701, which was very nuanced and, in the much maligned word, balanced. It was supposed to provide what Israel needed, as well as providing for some peace and possibly security for the south of Lebanon. But the sad truth is that the United Nations, particularly led by Secretary General Kofi Annan, just looked the other way and did not require, to this very day, that Hezbollah return the kidnapped Israeli soldiers, the two soldiers that they had come across the UN-certified boundary between Lebanon and Israel and had captured these two Israeli boys. They have not returned them to this day, nor are there any credible reports as to whether they're dead or alive and in what condition. Neither has Hezbollah disarmed or been forced to disarm, as that resolution required. Nor has Hezbollah given up its independent authority in the south of Lebanon. Sadly, tragically, if it were not so important, it would almost be comically, the UNIFIL, which has been a useless, feckless, ineffective force, and at worst, a cooperator with terrorists for 21 years, by the very name, UNIFIL.
Hold that thought for just a moment, please. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is Mr. Richard Hellman. Richard, do you have a telephone number? Do you have a website or anything material you'd like people to get in touch with you for?
Absolutely, Dr. Stan. As the Christian lobby for Israel, really the only biblically based lobby in Washington for the strong U.S.-Israel relationship at CPAC, we have a website. That is www.cpaconline.org. That's CIPACONLINE, cpaconline.org. And people can contact us, and that gives people all the information they need on the issues, how to join CPAC, how to participate in our effective lobbying actions, which have brought a number of real successes in American policy, to hold the terrorists at bay and to actually reverse their gains.
All right. Well, our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295 if you have a question for Richard. And, of course, he's very concerned about the survival of Israel at the present time. And I certainly am as well. The problem is that I think that there is nothing from a military point of view that is going to save Israel. I think only God's intervention is going to save Israel. But we're going to have to just see this unfolding. But I think this next few months is going to be a very trying time for both the Near East and the Middle East. I don't think the average American has any idea the implications of what we're facing if we do get into a war with Iran and Iran is able to close the Straits of Hormuz. You'll look back on $6 a gallon gasoline as the good old days. This will have a profound impact on the entire structure of our society, and Iran is working very, very closely with Chavez in Venezuela. And if those two countries were to shut off their oil supplies and, of course, to hit the Saudi oil supplies, this could really begin to paralyze the entire economy of the world. When you start a war, you never know how that war is going to end.
Yes.
And America is the most powerful nation in the world. We're also the largest debtor nation in the world. We're doing this whole war on borrowed money. How long can we continue borrowing money to maintain our military throughout the world? Richard, you go ahead, pick up the story.
Yes, I see where you're going, Dr. Stan, and I understand the difficulties and the problems that we have. We cannot as a nation live beyond our means, and so hopefully before long, our Congress, hearkening to the signals that were sent by the American public in the last election, which was less, I believe, a pro-liberal or pro-democratic result than it was a anti-Republican result, because the Republicans and the conservatives had not lived up to their principles. I believe we have to live within our means. I also believe that we must make the first serious, credible effort to reduce our dependence on foreign oil. And as you probably you know full well, and this may not sit well with some of my friends out in California, but I frankly believe, and I have always been a strong environmentalist, and I wrote large parts of many of America's environmental laws, but I believe the time has come when we must drill for oil and natural gas every place that it might occur, including, and this will shock you, on the White House lawn if there was a proven reserve under there. But we must use the highest and best technologies to protect against environmental damage, and we must hold the companies to a strict standard of liability for any damage whatsoever. And if you look at what happened with Katrina and Rita, the hurricanes in the Gulf, not one teacup of oil was spilled despite these horrendous, Category 5 storms. And so I believe today the technology is there. With proper government supervision, we can exploit the natural reserves, including tar sands and oil shale reserves in America and Canada, and cease our dependence on anti-democratic dictators, whether they be in the Persian Gulf or in Latin America.
And I certainly would agree with you. How do you feel about nuclear power?
I still have a question mark in my mind about nuclear power, because we really have not resolved the long-term problem of nuclear waste storage and disposal. And also, there is always that, maybe it's one in a million, but it's a tough decision when you have a live nuclear reactor and the possibility of something like Chernobyl, if you have some kind of a catastrophic engineering failure.
But of course, wasn't Chernobyl an entirely different construction? My understanding, it had a tar roof. It did not have a containment a chamber for the nuclear power. And you mentioned, what would we do with this fuel? Why don't we reprocess it like every other nation in the world does?
Well, we hopefully we can, and I'm not just drawing a line in the sand and saying no nuclear power. In fact, we are moving toward responsible nuclear power, and I just hope and pray that our engineers get it right this time. And what happened at Three Mile Island, which was a close call, thankfully it did not have long-term or catastrophic dangers, but there have been several close calls like this. But hopefully today, as you say, the technology is there, and of course we have a nation like France in which a large percentage of their electric power is generated by nuclear reactors. So hopefully we are getting to that stage. Well, that will be a part of the mix. And, of course, something which we had hoped would come along but wondered if it would ever constitute a significant part of our electric power generation, that being wind power and even geothermal power, now are looking more encouraging, at least for a percentage of our electric power generation, if not the major load.
What percentage of our, practically, what percentage of the electricity used by a massive industrial power like the United States, what percentage of the electricity could we generate from wind power?
We probably, from wind, biomass, and other such so-called ecologically friendly power sources, could probably aggregate 10% of our total load. But that is significant when you think of how big America's power demand is and how important that marginal 10% is to reducing dependence on foreign oil, including oil from the Gulf.
Well, I think I agree with you. We certainly would want to develop all the oil that we can and all the energy resources that we possibly can.
Yes.
So we would not be dependent upon what's going on in the Middle East, which is, well, just like a seething, a lass of lava ready to explode. Our telephone number is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. What do you see happening in the Middle East here in the next 6 months?
Well, I see an improvement, not a complete cessation of our problems in Iraq by any means, but there has been a learning curve for our military and our Pentagon and even our State Department, just as Israel has had a learning curve each time it was confronted by massive terror and so-called low-intensity warfare from the Palestinian Arab forces. It takes 3 years or more, it appears, to learn the enemy's tactics and strategies and to counter them. So I believe, with or without the surge that has been proposed and advanced by President Bush, we will see improvement in Iraq's situation. Not a complete victory, not a smoothly functioning democracy with all the freedoms we're used to, but a marked improvement. Already we have seen economic improvement. At the same time, I believe Israel will be back in a war situation before long, because already they are suffering under a rain of rockets from Gaza and potential terrorist attacks from Gaza and from Judea, Samaria, or the West Bank, and threats from Syria and Hezbollah continue. So I believe Israel is preparing herself, including systems to counter the rockets, which seem to have free play in the last war.
Well, I really think this, it's terrible when, because you see those rockets coming in. There's a place called Sderot. Is that, am I pronouncing it right?
Pardon me?
There is a place in Israel called, I would pronounce it Sderot. It must be in the south.
Oh, Sderot.
Sderot. They've actually pretty well abandoned that. A lot of the people have just moved out because of the repeated rockets coming in. And the thing is that the IDF, the Israeli Defense Force, is not allowed to attack the places where the rockets are coming from. And I think this is really disillusioning the average Israeli. He's saying our leaders are not attacking the people who are attacking, killing our people.
Yes, and what we find is that Israel, as a functioning democracy, where all the points of view can be presented freely and openly, and where change can be made, I believe that without saying what Israel ought to do, because as a free democracy they must do what they see right, I think it would be fair to say that with more than 80% of the Israeli public considering the present government as corrupt, and a similar percentage opposing the governance particularly the defense posture of the present government. I believe it is just a matter of time, and not a long time, before they have a vote of confidence in the Israel government, and under a parliamentary democracy, as you well know, that government can fall any time they lose a vote of confidence, and then new elections would be held. And there are some well-known figures waiting in the wings to take the places of the present government, and some less well-known figures who really embody what I would call a biblical Zionist and a nationalist, in the best sense of the word, of those words, point of view for Israel.
Well, who would you thinking of? Who specifically? I mean, the only name that comes to my mind is Netanyahu.
Yes.
Do you feel that he would be a leader for a time like this?
Well, there is a question because, of course, like other leaders, when elected, he did not always or necessarily follow the principles he espoused before his election.
That is so true. I mean, that was such a disappointment. I would like Netanyahu. Maybe because he speaks such good English.
Oh, he speaks brilliantly. No one speaks better.
But, of course, politicians say one thing, and then we get in power. They did not follow through, and that's unconscionable. I'd like to see men of principle in power in Israel. I'd like to see men of principle in power here in the United States.
Absolutely. This is what we are looking toward, and this is what we, we are a registered lobby, CPAC, the Christian Lobby for Israel, but we are not allowed to support or oppose candidates for office, of course. But just on the point of view of expert opinion as to what we observe, Bibi Netanyahu did a masterful job of guiding and restoring the Israel economy when he was finance minister up until just before the withdrawal from Gaza when he quit in protest, although quite late in the game and without any marked effect. But he was a good finance minister, and as prime minister, he defended Israel and was known for a strong response against terrorists. And of course, he had been, like his brother Yoni, who sadly died in the Entebbe raid, the only one to die in 76 in Uganda, recovering those captives from the PLO. Benjamin Netanyahu was a commander of one of their elite special operations units, and so he knows what to do. So perhaps the next time around, we will see a strong, resolute, and independent Israel. At the same time, others are coming up, and I just named two, for example, Dr. Aryeh Eldad, E-L-D-A-D, is someone to watch. He was the Surgeon General of the Israel Armed Forces, a general commanding all of the Israel military medical facilities, staff, and personnel. And he is a brilliant reconstructive surgeon who has been noted for repairing the terrible burns and injuries of people who have been injured in terrorist attacks and other attacks. He has even restored Palestinian Arab terrorists from the ravages of their own bombs that have gone off and torn them apart, and he has put them back together. And so he is he's an excellent and principled leader of the National Union faction, National Unity faction of the Knesset. And another I'll name is General Effie Etam, E-I-T-A-M, Ephraim Etam, who was a brilliant general in the Israel Defense Forces, and now has been a leader in the religious party, which has now linked up with the National Unity Party. And so he is coming on strongly also, and I think we'll hear more from him in years to come.
Well, I see. Well, is your organization a 501c3, or how are you financed?
Well, actually, CPAC is a 501c4. That is to say, it is a registered lobby, and therefore the membership dues of people who join CPAC are not tax-deductible for them, although the organization is a nonprofit or not-for-profit organization. It's not tax-deductible. It is not tax-deductible for contributors. However, we have another organization called Merkel, or better named perhaps Miracle, M-E-R-C-L, the Middle East Research Center Limited, and that is a 501c3 educational, informational, and charitable organization. And that, of course, is able to help CPAC, the lobby, within certain constraints with its work.
Boy, if they've got so many rules and regulations, it's just hard sometimes to get your job done.
Yes, but thank God for America and the rule of law, amen, so that we are not at the whim or fancy of some arbitrary or dictatorial ruler, and we have rights which, of course, we must defend and protect even within our country.
Amen. Hold that thought. Well, our guest this evening is Mr. Richard Hellman, and, of course, we've been talking about what's going on in the Near East, the Middle East, and, of course, he's with CPAC. Is it CPAConline.com?
No, CPAConline.org.
CPAConline.org, okay.
Uh-huh.
All right, fine. Well, now you've got about 2.5 minutes to wrap up the program, Richard. What message would you like to leave with our listeners tonight?
Well, on behalf of CPAC, the Christian Lobby for Israel, we are raising a massive force of citizen lobbyists from California to New York and from Alaska to Florida in every region, in every state, in every congressional district. So I call upon all of the listeners within sound of our voice tonight to contact us at CPAConline.org. Our telephone number is 202-234-3600, 234-3600 in Washington, D.C. We're right here at 1300 Pennsylvania Avenue in the Ronald Reagan Building between the White House and the Capitol. And we, you and I, can bring some light, some sanity, some truth, and some practical action to implementing the best of American principles in our policy toward Israel and in our policy toward the other states of the Middle East, including Egypt, which I agree with you, needs to reform and really live up to the principles that it has agreed to in its peace treaties, for example, with Israel. And Saudi Arabia must give its people more freedom and allow, for example, Christians and others to worship within the country, if President Bush's statement of a free Middle East really is to have reality. That's what we're working for. I need all of your help, but I believe we can get it done.
All right, fine. Well, I appreciate everything you do. I wish you well. I just don't know how we're going to be able to change the worldview of so many people here who are involved with the, you know, with the Muslim religion. I think the only thing that's going to change it is a religious conversion.
Yes.
Away from the Muslim faith,
yes,
towards Christianity. This is the only thing that will set them free from what I believe is a very, very evil religion.
Well, Dr. Stan, I believe that either winning them to the Lord to be true Christians, or the other alternative is for those of the radical Islamic leaders who oppose what America stands for.
Hold that thought. Hold it. Well, Richard was just telling us what his solution was, and so certainly he agreed with me that we should try to lead them to the Lord, but go ahead, finish your thought.
Yes,
there.
Excuse me. The other, but otherwise, we must oppose those despotic rulers of nations and also of groups like Al-Qaeda, Hezbollah, Hamas, and even to this day, the PLO. If they are attempting to enslave their people and bring terror and war and destruction and bloodshed to us, to our people, and to our shores.
All right, fine. Well, thank you so very much, and we'll appreciate you being with us for this hour. It's been a real pleasure.
Thank you, Dr. Stan.
Bye-bye.
Good being with you.
All
God bless
right.
you.
And you too. Bye-bye. That was Mr. Richard Hellman from CPAC, and we're, of course, I think that we are really at a crossroads, and I believe that President Bush is in very real trouble. His popularity has been plummeting. He probably has about a 30% support across the country for his policies in Iraq. My fear is that he is going, of course, to solve the problem in Iraq by attacking Iran. In other words, it'll be a great diversion. We won't be so worried about Iraq and the chaos there. And now we'll be worried about the chaos in Iran. And if he's able to pull this off, of course, and stabilize the country and overthrow the existing government, he'll end up a hero. And if he fails, why, we'll be plunged into a quagmire that I feel would destroy the very fabric of this society, and I'm not willing to take the gamble on it. But then I don't have that decision to make. I wonder how you feel about, well, we'll be talking more about that in the next few days, but pray for America and pray for revival. Understand that behind everything going on are powerful spiritual forces, and if you look at what's going on logically, none of it makes sense. Why would we be building up the military for Egypt when they're going to use that against Israel? Why would we be funding and training and arming the Palestinians when they're going to use that against Israel? Unless nothing here is as it appears to be. Unless Ahmadinejad is playing a part. If our people are playing a part, an awful lot of people are getting killed over there. Iraqi people, they're losing everything. Over almost 2 million Iraqis have fled the country, and the figure seems to be fairly accurate. About 600,000 Iraqis are dying, and in Afghanistan, it's totally chaotic, and the poppy fields are blooming. And why would they be blooming when we control the country? Are we really trying to stop the drug trade, or is everything smoke and mirrors? Nothing as it appears to be. And those of you who heard our opening remarks this evening about Vietnam and asking you, is it reasonable that these things happened? I would ask you, is it reasonable that the things that are happening today are happening? Is there another agenda behind this? If you have not yet read my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, you need to get it. If you have not read my newsletters, they are available on the Internet. Please, of course, get at the material we have, Iraq, the Untold Story, the true story of why we're in Iraq, against the backdrop of all of the wars of the 20th century and the spiritual force that energized the wars that we fought. And then, of course, to understand the world revolution, the continuing world revolution, which began in 1776 and then in 1787. And then, of course, continues to this very day, where we recently toppled the government of Nepal and brought a communist regime to power. Why would we do something like that? If Fidel Castro and Cuba is really the enemy, is it reasonable to think that Bill Clinton and Janet Reno would have spent 125 heavily armed, a special, trained force to Miami to kidnap the little Elian Gonzalez from an unarmed family and send him back to Fidel Castro, if Fidel Castro is really the enemy? Nothing really makes sense unless you understand we're involved in a spiritual battle for the souls of men and the survival of Christian civilization. And so please pray for America. Pray for revival. Pray for our leaders and our ministers. But please pray for my ministry of Radio Liberty, for our provision and for our protection. And so until tomorrow evening, when we'll be back with you once again, this is Dr. Stan saying good night, and may the Lord be with you. Tuned.